So this hour really is to provide you an overview around the Windows Azure platform, and specifically about Windows Azure. And I'm going to show you a couple of demos, and hopefully the internet connection is going to stay alive. That is also the reason why we start a little bit later. We had to reboot that thing there. My name is Beat Schwegler, and I'm responsible for cloud computing in Western Europe, and therefore very much working with Windows Azure. If you look at the Windows Azure platform, and I was already mentioning this morning, it consists of three bits, and you're going to have sessions on all these three bits. So I'm going to cover Windows Azure, which covers compute and storage, and then there's going to be SQL Azure, and at the very end, we're also going to have the Windows App Fabric, which is kind of middleware in the cloud. So it's important to understand that if we talk about storage in Windows Azure, we are not talking about relational databases. And you're going to see the difference there fairly soon when I dig into some of the details of Azure storage. If you look at Windows Azure, this is nothing you can buy. So you can't buy Windows Azure in a shop and install it in your data center. Windows Azure is a service, so that means we operate it for you. We maintain it for you, we patch it for you. And high level, you can think about this like one big fabric. And the way this fabric is controlled is through this so-called fabric controller. That fabric controller talks to all the servers there and spans up the multiple different VMs depending on your needs. It also realizes that maybe some VM should rather run on this server to get closer to some other activity that happens around this server. If one server needs to be patched, we span up another server, put on the VM there, patch it, and then move it over again. So that is really the capability of the fabric controller. You are interacting with the fabric. And within what that means is you get instances of virtual machines. So you never get access to the physical server. You can't have access to the physical hardware there. You get access to the virtual machine. And you define what size of virtual machines you want to have, so how many cores you want to have. But there are four different versions available. So this is not a scale-up scenario. It's really a scale-out scenario. So writing applications means we need to write them in a way that we can scale them out with multiple instances running in parallel. What you also see is the fabric really then manages storage and it manages something that we call role. And we have two types of roles. We have one role that runs within the context of IIS, the so-called web role. That's where we run, for instance, ASP.NET applications. That's where we run also PHP on top of FastCGI. And then there is a worker role, which is nothing else than just a task. Think about you have a start and an end, and in between you're going to have a while loop where you basically wait for a message or you wait for an incoming connection. If you would implement your own web server, you would do this in a worker role, and you would open up port 88 and we just listen and process and dispatch all the incoming requests. So let's have a deeper look into this concept of roles. The one thing which is tremendously important is to understand that when you have a project, you set up your architecture and you define your different project types, you're actually defining also what roles you're going to use. So for the front end, whether these are web services or ASP.NET sites, you're going to use web roles because they run in the context of IIS. So for instance, if you have, again, a shopping site, you might have one front end and you might have multiple instances of that particular role. So you tell then the system, please run 5 times the same virtual instance of that role. So that's how you scale. You basically tell the fabric it should launch another role, or another instance of the same role, or it should basically deduct the amount that you have. You just tell the number of instances you would like to have per role. And the same applies then to the worker role. The worker role really is the back end that you have. That's where you're going to do the number crunching. That's where you're going to do the back end tasks. To really scale, it is very important that within the web role, you do not keep any state. Because every entry, as you see here, to your system, so every HTTP or HTTPS request goes through a load balancer before it hits your particular role instance. That means if you have 10 role instances, they're all the same role. They're all, for instance, your web shop, but you have 10 instances of this front end installed. What that means is you never know what customer goes to what instance. So you really need to be very careful with state. So if you want to, for instance, have a shared state, you would implement this using Azure Storage. So you would actually access the session state through Azure Storage. You wouldn't keep it within your instance. The worker role is very similar. If you open a port to the public, so an external port, it actually goes through load balancers. So every external connection that is made to a role goes through load balancers. And that really is important in the way you write your software. Communication between role instances, so not only role types, but also role instances, is actually going through queues. So we're going to use queues where we put messages in there. So someone writes a message, and then the other one processes it. The web page that processes the shop creates a message that the shopping cart is ready for foreclosure. The message is created, and the backend then picks up that message and processes that shopping cart. So it's fairly straightforward. The other thing which is important to know, if a server dies, that role that will then be, so that instance that obviously then is not running anymore will then be spanned up somewhere else. So you have guaranteed the number of instances that you're actually requesting. So the rest of the talk, now before I do this, I think I'm going to show you how that looks like, because the rest of the talk is going to be mainly around storage. So what I will do is I will actually create a... And the reason why I need to run this, you might have seen I run Visual Studio as an administrator. The reason for this is I can quickly explain. When you do Windows Azure and you want to develop it locally and you want to use the API, you install the Windows Azure SDK. On top of this, with the SDK, you get a developer fabric. What that means is we provide you a Azure Fabric on your development PC that mimics all the load balancing, that mimics all the storage. So you have blob storage, queues, tables on, for instance, my PC. And to activate this, I need to run Visual Studio as administrator so I can debug it and run the actual development fabric. So that is the reason why I've done this. So if you want to start, you simply download the SDK, current version is 1.2, and you're also going to download the Visual Studio tools, and then you're going to have project templates. So let's have a look at this. It's actually straightforward. I create a new project, and as you can see, I have now a project template, which is called Windows Azure Cloud Service. So I select this, let's say this is going to be Liz. And now I specify my project of which type of roles does this consist. So I can have multiple web roles if I have different type of websites or like ASP.NET projects. And I can have multiple worker roles. In my case, I'm going to pick a ASP.NET web role and a worker role so I can show you how they look like. So I have two role types now within my project. If you're familiar with ASP.NET, you recognize that there is actually no magic involved. And that's what I was saying. It is extremely familiar with what you already know. So you have your web role, that's the ASP.NET project, and the worker role, which is my worker role. And I have up front here, this is another project, and that is the package that I'm going to deploy. And that also, as you see, contains the roles which will make this service deployment, and it contains a configuration file that allows me to specify how many instances I would like to run. So I'm going to say I would like to run 4 web roles. And that's what I'm now going to run on my development fabric. And I'm going to run 1 worker role. Before I do this, I'm actually going to just make some beautiful design. So let's just say hello Lisbon, eh? And let this run. So what happens in the background now? Obviously these projects get compiled and then the DLLs will be packaged as a service deployment. As you see, packaging the service deployment together with these configuration files that I just have. And then it's going to be sent to this guy here, which is my development fabric. Now, the development fabric spans now up based on the configuration, the different type of roles, and starts now also the browser that will now hit the URL of the development fabric to display this Hello Lisbon. Hello Lisbon site. Yeah, Hello Lisbon, you see that. You see the URL, it's obviously a local URL, it's my development fabric, so let's have a look at that guy. If you look at this guy that starts up now, the development fabric, you really kind of see what I have on my computer currently running in the dev fabric. So I have 4 web roles, and I have 1 worker role. So you can then dig into this stuff. So what would be interesting is if we would have a mechanism to see which instance serves now my browser. Just to kind of see whether the load balancer even works on the development fabric. So the way I can do this is I either gonna print the diagnostic message into these messages here. So as you see, I have 4 of them. So I could just print the message so we would see which role instance processed it. Or I could also get the ID so I could interact with the fabric and ask the fabric in which context did I run. So let's try to implement this. So to do so, I stop this guy. So now you see it's going to shut it down. Whoops. They go away. Yep, they go away. And I start to implement this functionality. So first of all, what I need is obviously a button. So let's add a paragraph first, and then let's add a button, and let's call this button hit me, huh? So this is the hit me button. And then I'm just going to create a label that I'm going to call instance name. It's like instance name. Okay. So if I hit this guy, I'm going now to retrieve from the actual fabric the instance name of my role. So how can I do this? I basically just interact with that fabric. And you see I can interact with the service runtime. The service runtime has something called role environment. In there I have my current role instance, and there I actually have an ID. Which really means the ID is nothing else than, oops, how did I call it? Instance? Ins name, exactly, dot text. So this is this guy, yeah? That kind of should display this. And now let's also do the diagnostic bit. So if you know diagnostic, I mean, this is extremely straightforward. It's really just system diagnostics. Let me, is there, so yeah, that is okay. System diagnostic, do I miss, oh yeah, I missed the eye. So it's after lunch, you know, all the blood is in the stomach rather in the brain. So diagnostics, trace, and simply do a right line. And I'm going to say, you got served by, oh, this is my touchpad, eh? You got served by, huh? And then we simply just going to add the instance name text here as well. Do you agree on this? Should work, shouldn't it? But the great thing now is if we really start to kind of test run that and see what type of instances are going to serve our client. So again, stuff gets packaged, gets deployed, instances are getting spawned up. So now it launches the browser. Okay, so it's role 1-1, eh? 1-1-1-1-0-1. Let me know. Okay, it looks like either role 1 or role 0 picks that up. I think we over-provisioned that system a little bit with 4 instances. So let's have a look at our guys here. And if you look here, did this guy here? Oh no, that's just saying it's working. Okay, that's fine. So if you look, it is basically the role 0 and role 1 which served all these requests now. But although it was from the very same client, it actually hit 2 instances. So there's no guarantee that even the same user is going to go always to the same instance. So that is kind of a crash start into how you deal with a web role, and then how you can interact with the role environment, and furthermore also to see how you increase the number of instances. And you also saw the development fabric. What I haven't showed you so far is the worker role. So if you look at the programming model of the worker role, it's extremely straightforward. You see that? Worker role, role entry, run. And then it's a while. So you basically do your job in between these two while brackets, these two brackets of the while loop. So you either read from message queues and wait for the other message, you either open a TCP connection and wait for a response, and so forth. This is really the difference between the web role and the worker role. So let's switch back to the presentation. So what we saw so far is the compute part. I will now drill into blobs, tables, queues, and drives, which is our storage. There are two things which are relevant for all storage that you have in Windows Azure. First of all, there is a RESTful API, so you can use XML over HTTP to connect to the storage and to do storage interactions. And there is actually a key that you use to authenticate yourself. So it's a secret key. So I come with this 512-bit key, and that means you as the storage is going to serve me on my interactions. The second way is also you go to a client library that gives you just.NET classes to interact with the storage. But you still need that key. That is the way you can interact with the stuff that is stored within a storage account. And what I mean with a storage account becomes very easy visible when we dig into blob storage. All the storage, so table queues and blobs, they're starting with something called an account. This is the key. This 512-bit key works for an account. You're basically going to give the account name, you give that key, and that means from then on, this guy talks to you and vice versa. So blob storage is really to store binary data. You can store your streaming data and so forth. So it's fairly straightforward. You create containers. So I could say I have a public container, I have a private container. So I set the permissions in the public container to read only, and in the private container I can say read write. And then furthermore, I can then also add obviously my blob elements. You might now ask, okay, isn't it a bit strange? How can I upload one video at once? So if you have a blob, which is a video of 100 meg, how do you upload this? So what you really do is, there is a smaller concept which is called block. So to upload it, you're actually going to say a put block. In small, so you digest your large binary data into small blocks, and then you can retry. At the end, when everything is up there, you just say, put block list. And that means the system puts all these blocks together to one blob. It's fairly straightforward. Now, there is actually something very interesting about blobs if you start to think about when you're building websites. You have a web role. That web role would like to embed a URL to a blob storage into the website that it serves back to the customer. That requires that blob container to be public viewable, because otherwise that URL can't be accessed by the client. So that's a tricky bit, as you see. You really would require to open up your storage for anonymous access. And it's not really something you might want to do. So there is something really, really cool. And that really, really cool thing is actually called shared access signature. What that means is, within my web role, I give my 512-bit key to this account and say, look, for this container, please create a shared access signature that I can use as my URL that is publicly visible for a certain time. So you're basically going to ask the blob storage to give you public access with a very strangely encoded URL, so you can embed that very strangely encoded URL into your website so it can be directly downloaded then. Does this make sense? So let's have a look how this works. And now, before I do this, I go to the rest of the storage, and then I think it's better we're gonna... That was something that we call the block blob. Now we also have something which we call page blob. Most likely this is something you might not directly use. But think about it. Sometimes you would like to have the mechanism of saying, I would like to have 1 gigabyte of storage. Or 100 gigabyte of storage. I would like to have this. But you do not want to have it continuously filled, but you would like to provide random access like on a file, like on a disk system, where you have pages. So what you do here is, you really provide them page access to that storage. So you reserve that full bucket. So you see that this dotted line is really the storage size I reserved. But I'm not paying for it. I just reserved it conceptually. And then I can read, obviously, wherever I want. But the writing is only possible in page sizes. So if the page size is 512 here, I only can read a multiply of 512, and the start reading point is always a multiply of 512. So these page sizes to write are hard. So you can't write one page above the alignment of two pages. But you can read this, but you can't write. So now you might think, why do we do this? I mean, why do I need this? Guess how did we implement this storage mechanism drive? We use blob storage, specifically page blobs, and mimic NTFS on top of it. If you want to implement the NTFS API, you exactly need this capability of working with pages. So a drive is actually nothing else. So an Azure drive is actually nothing else than the blob which is mounted over the network that provides an NTFS API on top of it. If you write to it, you need to take a lease. And only one can have a write lease. And if someone has a write lease, no one can have a read lease. Which means if you write, you own that disk. If you only have a read lease, other people can have a read lease as well. So how can you now work in a clever way with this? And we have something that's called snapshot. So you create a snapshot. If you have a write lease, you create a snapshot, and then everyone else takes the read lease based on that snapshot. So that is a mechanism how you can work on this data with multiple different instances, but only one can actually have a write lease. So let's have a quick look into tables. This is maybe the most challenging thing for all of us. And I think if you look at our industry, if we think data, many of us think databases. If we think databases, we think relational databases. We think queries and transactions. That's the way we got educated. That's the way many of our existing systems work. Unfortunately, for highly scalable systems, and also cheap systems, running on the relational databases is not an option because it's not designed to scale out. It's designed to scale up. So if you need to have a scale-out scenario, you're going to end up with non-relational data storages. You're going to end up with redundant data that can be partitioned across thousands of nodes. And the table is designed for this. And the structure is, again, very simple. Accounts, that's how you tell the how you tell Windows Azure who you are and what account you want to talk to. So in this case, I would have a Movie Online account. I'm going to have here then my Beat SCH account, which is my personal account. I authenticate myself using the key. And then I can create tables. And every table then can have properties. There is no table schema. So you can have one table which is called customer, but then some entries have seven columns and other entries only have four columns. And the same column phone number can be a string for some entries and it can be an integer for other entries. There is no schema. It's extremely flexible. And there are no relationships you define between these tables because you do not run queries across these tables. You also have transactions only within something that is called a partition. And I go into this in a second. Imagine if you have a large-scale web shop and you're going to have a table which is called items. So all the products that you have, and you might have millions of these items. Can you imagine that having them in one table is quite difficult if it gets above a certain size? Since we run on commodity hardware, we need to scale it out on multiple servers. But what is the mechanism? How can we decide what belongs together? And that's why we use the so-called partition key. You define a partition key. The partition key could be the type of stuff you sell, so it could be books belong together. The partition key, but could also be something completely different, something that you know is a good mean for scaling. Because the system takes advantage of the partition key and put stuff together which has the same key. And only within one partition, the row key needs to be unique. Which means you have now partition and row key makes you a unique identification of your entity. So it's really different than a relational database. But it's extremely powerful for large-scale systems. So let's have a look at partitions. I have a table where I store movies. And the partition key I have chosen is category, then a row key is the title. So that means I can now have two movies with the same name as long as they're in different partitions. And then I have timestamps and the release date. Timestamp is something the system adds automatically, and we use this for optimistic locking. So you can then see, you know, what happens. So I have now two, so to make you an example, if I want to run a transaction among partitions, I could actually run a transaction among actions, or I could run a transaction among animation. But there is no way I can run a transaction among action and animation because they're in different partitions. But the benefit you get from them is the system realizes, obviously, that they're in the same partition. So what it really does in scale-out scenarios is it keeps the partitions close and optimizes it, therefore, access for the transactions and obviously also for the queries you run. So that is the benefit you get. You can store large-scale archives, and if you have the right partition key, your system is tremendously responsive, but also highly scalable. The last bit I would like to touch is actually queues. Very simple again. Account, and then you have queues, the names, and in the queue you put a message. Now, for queues, I would like to focus on two things. First of all, when you place the message in the queue, once it has been accepted, it is persistent in there, it stays in there, it's reliably stored, because all the storage mechanisms you saw, blob, tables, drives, queues, they're actually three times redundantly stored within the data center, and then geo-redundantly stored within the geo, the same geo. If you use Europe as your deployment node, then it's going to be stored three times, obviously, in the same data center, plus in Dublin and Amsterdam. So these are the two data center locations in Europe. So it's extremely reliable and also available. So it's stored in there. And it's so long stored until someone tells, please delete it. So the way we work with queues is the following. Worker role waits. So someone put a message into the queue. Then the worker role is kind of listening, looking at the queue, reads the queue, and then it gets a message. Whoops. And it tells the queue, I take this message. Please make this message now invisible for 1 minute. So now the ticker runs, and I can try to do my task within that 1 minute. You can pick any time you want. You are defining this time. If you do not delete that message within that 1 minute, because you now did that task, that message becomes visible again in the queue, and someone else is going to pick it up. So what that really means that if you design the system not correctly, you might end up that multiple workers work on the very same message because you maybe the time was not long enough. Therefore, the key thing for message processing is it needs to be idempotent. Idempotent means if you do something many times, the outcome is always the same. So if you clean the floor, you can do this many, many times and the outcome is the same. You have a clear floor. Now, drinking beer is not idempotent because the outcome obviously is going to be increased with every beer you drink. So it's crucial to think about this. Getting money from a bank. So actually withdraw money from a bank is also not idempotent because after doing it maybe 100 times, you run out of your cash that you can get from the bank on a day. So these are very important concepts to understand, but they're fairly straightforward for everyone who used to be involved in loosely coupled systems. And the last bit is also the messages are not necessarily delivered and processed in the order they have been stored. So if you look now at an architecture that works with a queue, the key thing is that you do not store all information in the queue if we talk about images or if we talk about any other stuff that you could store in a table or in a blob. So what you really do is you store the task in the queue and maybe contextual information in the queue. But if there is additional stuff required, so like you wanna do a post-production of an image, then you store the image in the blob and you put a reference to the blob within the message. And the result obviously then goes into the blob storage as well. You're just going to say now, hey, the new version of this image is now available. Five storage options. And I think if you understand their characteristic, it is very clear which one you're going to use when. Tables are really for structured, highly scalable storage, not relational and not for highly transactional work. If you need, as an example, if you build a highly scalable web shop again, you will put most of the stuff into blobs and tables. However, your checkout system, that will use SQL Azure. But you're not going to have 10,000 people checking out on the very, very same moment. So it's a real difference of serving in scale and then having some tasks that need to be transactional. So really understanding what type of storage serves you for what type of requirement is an important thing. So we have these tables. Blob is clearly unstructured data that if it can be cached, you can actually also use the content delivery network which goes around the globe. So you can upload your images, your streaming data there, and we can cache it in our data centers. Azure Drive is really if you have applications, I wouldn't create applications necessarily on top of this paradigm of NTFS, but if you have existing applications and some portions read and write files, you would then actually mount an NTFS drive to mimic this. The queues are really mainly for inter-role communication, but because you can access these queues also from outside, just through REST, so XML over HTTP, any other endpoint on the internet that has the ability to talk to your account can actually post a message to the queue and read a message to the queue. So you can have mobile phones that basically post messages into the queue that you then process on the service backend using your worker roles. And last but not least, it's really SQL Azure for transactional database work. That really then brings us to this big picture of how do you write applications for Windows Azure? Web roles, worker roles. The thing is stateless. Load balancers are taking the incoming requests for worker roles, for web roles, as well as for storage. Both web role and worker role have access to storage. So if someone sends you a picture for post-production, you accept this in a worker role, in a web role. You save it in blob storage, and you create the message, put it into the queue. The worker role then picks that message up, looks what is the image, takes the image from the blob storage, does the post-production on that image, writes the new version of the image into the blob storage as well, and then the next time the user refreshes the site, the new image is going to be displayed. So the way, let's stop here. I think it's a good time to stop here and going to show you something. I have a little demo prepared here that does nothing else than reading. So in Visual Studio you also have, as part of the Server Explorer, you see here, this is Biatch. This is my live account that I have on Windows Azure. So the Windows Azure portal, let me show you this. I can simply go to the Windows Azure portal, browse to portal. Uh, As it's linked to my live ID, let's hope the connection is okay. Someone stands with its feet on the internet, so I can guarantee you this is not the website, but it is the connection. So you see, I have one project here which is called Cloud Beach. If I select this, I see now I have storage here that I call Big Storage, and then I have a service deployment that I call Hello World. If I go on this Hello World service deployment, you didn't see, what you really do is you take that package that I deployed to the development fabric, you just deploy it to this site. And you can do this out from Visual Studio by basically just saying, right click, publish. So I specify my credentials. This is this Cloud Beach. That's exactly the account I have. I'm going to specify whether I want to deploy it to production or staging environment. And then I specify the storage, so my big storage here. And then I deploy it. And it's actually live in the cloud then. So I've already done this. So that's what you see here now. This is my Portugal deployed on the 11th. And I could now upgrade it. What that means, I could change the .NET version. I could change, I could also, for instance, change the location where it's deployed. So you see geographical location is anywhere in Europe at the moment. So that means Dublin and Amsterdam. This is actually the URL of this site. So if I go here, you see, this is a Hello Portugal that does exactly the same thing that we just saw before. It now actually has 1 and 0. Yeah, that serves us. So fairly straightforward. The reason why I showed you this is, basically, if I want to increase the number of instances, I simply just have a configure. I can change this from 2, for instance, to 4, and I have 4 instances running in the cloud. So let me quickly go back to Visual Studio, because what I wanted to show you is how to work with images. So this is my Server Explorer here. This is Biatch, which is my account. And within this account, I have blob and tables. Within blob storage, I have images and for me. These are 2 containers that I created. Now, the important thing is the images container I created public, so anonymous, everyone can access. The for me is private. So what I would like to show you now, what that means for a website. I have here, and I go back to an other, so let's just hide that stuff, yeah, and that's, it's actually fairly simple. On a page load, what I do here, and the reason why I don't show you all the details is because it gets recorded, and my account key is in there as well. But believe me, what I do here is nothing else than just retrieve from the configuration environment my storage account. So you see, set configuration, setting publisher of cloud storage account. That's what I do. Once I have this, I then really can, and this is the data connection string, as you can imagine, that I just retrieved through these configuration settings. So the real code really starts down here. This is the URL for the public image. So if I put this into a web browser, I should be able to see that image. Ah, that's the wrong URL, as you can see. If I put it down to exactly this one here, I see it. Hey, by the way, this is where I live. Down here. So then this is the mountain behind in the back garden. So it's backyard. It's Mount Pilatus. So if you come to Luzern, you need to go up there. It's actually very, very nice. This is was obviously early in the morning. But it's lovely. But it's horrible weather now, so. No, wrong one. So this is the URL. I would like to, I have a web, as you see, I have a URL link here, and I have my image here. The image is called Hello Image. And then I just display the URL link. So very simple. So I have a web page where I would like to display an image. So this is my URL. So what I really need to do is, in this case, I can simply just give this URL without doing all that stuff here, which is fairly obvious. It's public, yes. The reason why I have this here is if I change this to for me. So let's have a look what happens if I would like to access the for me container. So this resource is not available. So what I will do here now is I will construct such a shared, I'll just walk you quickly through this. It's actually fairly simple. I create now such a shared access signature. I get access to my account. Now I create the Cloud Blob client, which is really just the programming model that I have available within .NET. I have my blob here. Then I get a reference to my image by handing over the URL. So the next thing then really is I create an instance of a shared access policy. I set the permission to read. Shared access start time is now. End time is basically now plus 10 seconds. This then I simply use to call this method get shared access signature. And that gives me the shared access signature that I can append to the end of the URL. So if I run this now, what you will see is that this URL will actually be displayed and the image is now visible. So you see, this is now the for me image. So this is the URL, which is, by the way, on the same mountain, just a little bit later in the day. If I now wait more than 10 seconds, and I try to use this URL, I get back to the previous issue, that resource is not available anymore. You see this also, if I, for instance, do not append the shared access URL here, so if I'm basically saying, I just go with the for me container, which obviously is not public, if I run this application, it will not be able to display this image. And you saw it's also time-bombed, so you can define how long this resource is going to be available. So, to summarize, I really would like now to go one step back and think about, look, all that thing we do that we're going to get access to cheap scalable storage and access to elasticity and scalable systems. There are two ways we can scale. We can scale up and scale horizontally. Now, scaling up, we only can choose between four different VM sizes, so that's not really an option. So what you really do is, if you scale horizontally, you increase the number of instances per role type. And the way to identify these instances, how many types you need, whether you need to go up and down, is you can look at the CPU meters, the queue sizes, the I/O capacity, or any other KPI that you might have that is a good indicator whether your application serves well or not. From a development perspective, if you do this in larger groups, it is important that what you see on top is the production environment, that you do not test on these production environments, and that you actually separate the production keys from the test keys. So the way you should work is you do testing with the development fabric, then you can actually do local testing by accessing the storage, which is in the cloud. So that's what you saw here. These pictures were stored in the blob storage in Ireland, where the application run here on my development fabric. So you can mix these two bits. And once you think you're fine, you do the integration tests, you then can go for a test environment where you do staging and production. And only if this is all okay, you actually hand it over to the actual deployment and ensure that the access keys there are obviously not placed among all developers. So that is the idea there, and it's fairly straightforward. From a pricing perspective, I already was saying there are three dimensions. It's compute, it's storage, and it's bandwidth. That's what we charge. So it's fairly predictable if you understand how you use your applications. If you would like to learn more in detail how you can integrate with existing applications, existing systems, I really recommend you to have a look at this patterns and practices, developing applications for the cloud. It's actually a superb guide, and it's also available as a book. It's a really good piece of work that gives an end-to-end view of working with Windows Azure. And that really brings me to the end. And the ones who were in a session this morning, they just realized it's the same conclusion. Because I think these are the key things to take away. It's a platform. You do not need to install the software first. You do not need to patch the operating system. You simply just upload your package and you say how many instances you want. That's extremely powerful because you are developing software and not operating and maintaining the system. As you saw, everything I showed you was familiar. I mean, it was Visual Studio. I had the same debuggers in there. I had the same test environment in there. The development fabric is running on your computer. It runs on C#. You have an SDK. You have tools, project templates. It's extremely familiar. But if you want to integrate something that you do not get through Visual Studio, this is not a problem. So for instance, we have PHP, we have Eclipse plugins, and so forth. And everything is accessible from a storage perspective. Everything is accessible to a RESTful API as well. Also, the management of the role management is also accessible through a RESTful API. And last but not least, the sweet spot really is this symmetry between what you can do on-premise and what you can do in the cloud. I mean, the thing I did here, I run that web server locally here in my development fabric. But the blob storage was actually in Ireland. So you can start to really do interesting things by, for instance, say, look, certain type of data I need to keep close. I keep that with me. Other type of data, that's okay. That's going to be in the cloud. That's going to be highly scalable. That needs to be archived and so forth. And because this symmetry exists between Windows Server and the Windows Azure platform, you really can kind of take the best out of both worlds. So I hope you kind of got a good feeling of what Windows Azure can offer you. There are sessions afterwards on SQL Azure and on the App Fabric, so the other bits of the actual platform. And the best place to start with is really windowsazure.com. There you find some great training kits, great videos, but also access to the actual platform where if there would be a rainy